The LexisNexis Corporate and Securities Law Community Podcast. Presentations and interviews with leading attorneys and industry professionals. On this edition, Alex Bond of Hogan Lovells on the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Credit Suisse Securities versus Simmons. The opinions expressed by guests on LexisNexis legal podcasts do not necessarily reflect those of Reed Elsevier Incorporated, LexisNexis, subsidiary companies, shareholders, employees, or customers, and should not be considered legal advice. Alex Bond is an attorney with Hogan Lovells, whose practice is focused on corporate and securities law matters, including all aspects of corporate governance, compliance with federal securities laws and stock exchange listing standards, securities offerings, and various other corporate matters. Alex has particular experience advising companies, investment entities, and individuals on complex securities law matters, including navigating beneficial ownership reporting obligations and avoiding short swing liability and insider trading violations. Alex also regularly advises clients on SEC disclosure and reporting requirements and annual meeting and proxy-related matters, including handling sensitive executive compensation disclosure requirements and responding to shareholder proposals.
Today we're going to be talking about the recent Supreme Court decision in Credit Suisse versus Simmons, a case that has centered on the statute of limitations under Section 16B of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. Today we're going to talk briefly about an overview of what Section 16 is, provide a brief history of the case in the lower courts, and some discussion and analysis of the Supreme Court's decision in the case and what it means for practitioners going forward. So with that, let's start briefly with what Section 16 is. Most people are familiar with the two main provisions that were at issue in the Simmons case, which are Section 16A and 16B. 16A is the reporting provision of the statute, and it generally provides that directors, officers, and greater than 10% equity holders of public companies, which are referred to commonly as insiders, are required to file reports with the SEC, typically on a Form 4, which Form 4s report transactions in the company's equity securities by those insiders. This includes transactions such as purchases and sales, but also picks up other forms of transfer, such as gifts. Section 16B is a related provision, and it's often called the short swing profit rule. And that generally provides that profits that are realized from short swing transactions by these insiders may be recovered by the company or by a security holder acting on the company's behalf. A short swing transaction is a purchase and a sale, or a sale and a purchase, either way, that occurs within a period of less than 6 months. And if you realize profits in a short swing transaction, the company may seek to recover that amount, or as I mentioned, a private security holder of the company may sue on the company's behalf to recover that amount. So there's an interest in the plaintiff's bar for seeking these types of disgorgement, typically because plaintiff's attorneys in this arena are eligible to receive a portion of the profits recovered as fees for their services. Importantly, under Section 16, the private right of action to recover short swing profits is subject to a statute of limitations. And this provision provides that no suit to recover profits shall be brought more than 2 years after the date such profit was realized. Now, while this language seems clear at first blush, it's the interpretation of this language that was the result, or that was the subject, rather, of the Simmons case, and which ultimately made its way to the highest court in the country. So with that background of what Section 16 is, let's talk a little bit about Simmons' case and how it started. In 2007, Vanessa Simmons, the plaintiff in the lawsuit, brought suit against 54 financial institutions that had served as underwriters in numerous technology IPOs in the late 1990s. Simmons' claim was that those underwriters had become 10% owners of those IPO companies, making the underwriters subject to Section 16. Now, she also alleged that the underwriters had engaged in unlawful practices in those IPOs, including how the underwriters had allocated shares in the IPO companies to potential purchasers. And as a result of those unlawful practices, the underwriters were ineligible for a key exemption from Section 16 that normally would apply to IPO transactions and transactions in the aftermarket. As a result, the complaints allege that these IPO underwriters were subject to Section 16A and Section 16B, which means that they were subject to disgorgement for the profits that they had realized in transacting in the company's IPO shares. Not only that, they were also required to file reports under Section 16A to report those transactions. Of course, the underwriters contested that provision and contested those allegations and had never filed Section 16A reports on the belief that they were not subject to Section 16 in the first place. This case, which was filed in the Western District of Washington, was ultimately dismissed as to all of the 54 financial institutions. The district court dismissed 30 of the institutions on different grounds than were the subject of the case that went forward to the Supreme Court. The 24 institutions had a different, the other 24 institutions rather, had a different argument than the other 30, and it primarily was centered on the statute of limitations that I had mentioned under Section 16. They claimed that since their transactions that had occurred in the late 1990s were, you know, nearly 7 years old by the time Simmons filed her complaint in 2007, that the entire suit was time barred under Section 16's statute of limitations. And the court agreed and dismissed the 24 counts on that ground. Simmons then appealed the dismissal based on the statute of limitations to the Ninth Circuit. And interestingly, the Ninth Circuit reversed the district court, relying on its prior decision in a case called Whitaker v. Whitaker Corp. to hold that 16B statute of limitations is essentially tolled until an insider discloses the transactions in question in a report filed under Section 16A, thus essentially giving the plaintiff access to the facts that would support a claim for disgorgement. So under the Ninth Circuit's view, the statute essentially is tolled until such time in the future as a 16A report is filed, which, you know, could be never. So following the Ninth Circuit's decision, the banks then sought appeal of the decision to the Supreme Court, which granted cert in 2011 and heard oral argument in the case later in that year. On March 26th, the court rendered its opinion, which was authored by Justice Scalia. Chief Justice Roberts did not participate in the decision or the consideration of the case, which actually had an impact on the court's decision, as I'll explain. The Supreme Court's question that it was essentially presented with was whether that 2-year statute of limitations in Section 16 is able to be tolled at any point. And if so, what are the circumstances that would be required for it to be tolled? Now, Simmons, well, there were three different approaches that were presented to that question. One approach was presented by Simmons, the plaintiff. One was presented by the IPO underwriters, the defendants. And the third was presented by the United States, which had come to the case in an amicus capacity because it obviously has an interest in how Section 16 operates. The Simmons provision, or the Simmons argument, obviously relied on the Ninth Circuit's decision, which was supported by the Whitaker case, that the 16B statute of limitations is tolled until the defendant insider files a Section 16A report. The IPO underwriters, on the other hand, argued that 16B's statute of limitations is what they call a period of repose, meaning it cannot be extended under any circumstances, and the 2-year statute of limitations is essentially a fixed period. Now, the United States took a middle ground and presented a third option, which essentially was that the statute of limitations is subject to tolling, but it's not subject to tolling until a report is filed under 16A. Rather, it would just be tolled until a potential plaintiff had notice of the facts to support a claim for disgorgement under 16B. Now, unfortunately, given the fact that Chief Justice Roberts had not participated in the decision of the court was unable to reach a majority consensus on the threshold question of whether Section 16's statute of limitations is able to be tolled. The court split 4-4 on that question. So observers that were hoping for a definitive answer to that question obviously were disappointed. Therefore, as a result of this split, the 4-4 split, the court had no choice but to affirm without precedential value the Ninth Circuit's decision that 16B's statute of limitations is subject to tolling, even though four of the justices did not believe that that's the case. So although the court was unable to agree on that question, whether the statute of limitations can be told. The court said that assuming that it is told, it would not be told based on the Ninth Circuit's position. Rather, it would be told based on traditional principles of equitable tolling. So the court struck down the Ninth Circuit's Whitaker rule and took issue with the fact that the Ninth Circuit's position ignores the plain meaning or the plain language of Section 16, which provides simply that the two-year statute of limitations runs from the date the profit was realized. The court reasoned that if Congress had intended to toll the statute of limitations until the report was filed under Section 16A, Congress certainly would have done so. The court also noted that the Ninth Circuit's position and view would allow tolling under 16B to continue until well beyond the point when a plaintiff would be aware of the facts that would support a claim for disgorgement. And the Simmons case is a perfect example of this. The underwriters, as I mentioned, had never filed any reports under Section 16A on their belief that they and their transactions in the IPOs were not subject to Section 16 in the first place. So since they'd never filed any reports, if Simmons' position were to be taken, that would mean that she still has 2 years from today to file her case under Section 16B. So you can obviously see how that would present an illogical result, and the court was very mindful of that. So assuming, of course, now that tolling is permissible, which again is the question the court was unable to come to a majority consensus on, the court held that if it was to be tolled, you would apply the traditional principles of equitable tolling, which generally require a plaintiff to establish two things. First, that he or she has been pursuing his or her rights diligently. And two, that some extraordinary circumstances stood in his or her way. As the court pointed out, allowing the statute of limitations to be tolled beyond the point when the plaintiff would otherwise be aware of the facts to support a claim, that would produce an inequitable and inconsistent result. So at the end of all of this, the court vacated the portion of the Ninth Circuit's decision on tolling and remanded it for further consideration to the lower courts of how traditional principles of equitable tolling would apply in the Simmons case. So what does all of this mean? I guess starting with the immediate impact with the Simmons case is going to go back down to the lower courts, and they're going to have to determine, based on this decision, whether the traditional principles of equitable tolling would apply to Simmons' complaint. I tend to think that Simmons is not going to have a strong position here because the district court had noted that she, in fact, had access and knowledge of the facts underlying her claim at least 5 years before she brought the suit. So if you were to apply the Supreme Court's analysis to that, you would come to the realization that even if the 16B statute of limitations were told, it was only told until she had notice of the facts underlying the claim, which was more than 2 years before the date that she filed the suit. So I tend to think that she's not going to have much success prevailing in the case on remand. But obviously, this decision has larger impacts than just beyond the Simmons case. The court's decision leaves wide open the question still of whether or not 16B provides for tolling at all for the statute of limitations, or whether there is in fact a period of repose that's a fixed two-year period. So although there's some certainty provided by the Supreme Court's rejection of the Ninth Circuit's Whitaker rule, the lower courts are still going to have to wrestle with arguments about whether tolling is permitted in the first place. And even if they decide that it is, there's going to be questions of whether the traditional principles of equitable tolling in these cases should apply based on the facts. So I think what we're likely to see is in 16B cases that are brought more than 2 years after the alleged profits were realized, there's going to be a factual battle that's going to have to be waged by both the plaintiffs and the defendants to determine whether the plaintiff had knowledge of the facts that would have supported the claim more than 2 years before the suit was filed. So that's going to add a little bit of interesting wrinkle, I think, to lawsuits under Section 16B. And defendants are probably going to try to point to any and all forms of public documentation that they can get their hands on to show that the plaintiff should have had knowledge of the facts underlying the claim more than 2 years before the suit was filed. I would guess they'll point to filings under Section 13 of the Exchange Act, They'll point to litigation records, point to documents that are filed by the subject company, you know, material contracts, purchase and sale agreements, you know, things like that. You know, anything they can do to try to build the case that the knowledge should have been held by the plaintiff well before the suit was filed. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. You know, there were a lot of arguments in the case about how Whitaker, the Ninth Circuit's Whitaker rule, served an important purpose. And that was that by requiring a Section 16A report to be filed to serve as the basis for the claim, you know, that's really the easiest way for a plaintiff to get a hold of the facts necessary to bring a 16B disgorgement claim. Now, of course, it's not the only way. As we saw in Simmons, no 16A reports were ever filed, but she was able to bring a claim under 16B for disgorgement anyways. But, you know, I'd say most, if not a vast majority, of the 16B claims, you know, do center on 16A reports. And that's the easiest way for plaintiffs to get that information. However, I think the court was right to reject the Whitaker rule, because if you take it to its extreme, it would allow a 16B claim to lie in wait, potentially in perpetuity, if the insider never files a Section 16A report. And that's irregardless of whether the insider actually believes that it's required to file a 16A report in the first place. So I think the court's decision was right on that part of it. But as I mentioned, there's going to be a fair amount of hand-wringing and fact-finding in the lower courts in future actions based on the fact that the Supreme Court was unable to come to a definitive conclusion about whether the Section 16 statute of limitations is subject to tolling at all in the first place. So stay tuned to see what happens next. This has been Alex Bond from Hogan Lovells, and I appreciate everyone for listening.
Thank you for listening to this LexisNexis Legal Podcast, a free service of the LexisNexis communities. Like the communities on Facebook, follow them on Twitter. The LexisNexis Corporate and Securities Law Community Podcast, copyright 2012 by LexisNexis, a division of Reed Elsevier Incorporated.